Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Oh, hello, it's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring and provoking us lately. Gathered around the table this Thursday, we've got Danielle Riendo.
Hi.
Riendo.
Got it.
Need to hit that pronunciation a little harder.
Yeah, it's fine. They're both right.
Yeah, but one's just a little too French. And we also have Natalie Watson.
Hi.
So before we dive into today's topic, some caution warnings you should probably bear in mind. We're going to be talking about drug abuse, particularly opioid abuse and overdoses. So be warned, it's a super upbeat episode of Waypoints this week.
Yeah.
But we're going to be dealing with some pretty heavy stuff, so Bear that in mind before we continue along. We're going to open with a discussion of Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, which, Natalie, this was your waypoint for the week. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
My waypoint for this week was Roma. I originally watched it a couple weeks ago. I got the chance to see it in 70mm at the Alamo in Brooklyn.
Nice.
Which means a lot to a lot of people, and I means nothing to me. I am not like a film. Sorry, Rob.
Rob just tossed his headphones.
It was a vicious throw. I rewatched it. Here's what I'll say. I rewatched it last night on Netflix on my computer, and I can tell the difference. Yes. I'm glad the first time I watched it was in theaters, at the very least, if not, in with that incredible mix and seeing it on a projector and everything. So, that was Roma.
Did you have any history with Cuarón films? Like, are you a fan of the director? Or, Children of Men certainly is probably one of my favorite, like, dystopian mm-hmm. sci-fi films. But it turns out I've been a fan of Cuarón since I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. He made a movie that has some problematic elements at mm-hmm. this point. But he made A Little Princess, mm-hmm. Danielle, which I think you and I are of a generation to remember that as
as
a kid's movie. And it's still a damn good kids movie. More than a little orientalizing, but still kind of a beautiful fable of like turn of the century New York.
Yes, yeah. Agreed.
I am a fan of Alfonso. His greatest work and my first introduction to him was Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Genuinely, that is the best movie.
It's the best one out of all of them. I don't know why. It just is.
Cinematography.
The cinematography is incredible. The way that it's so good. But this is not that podcast. I haven't seen many of his many of his other films, except I did see Gravity relatively recently. So that was the other one. I wanted to see Y Tu Mamá También, but oh my god.
Good.
But I haven't seen it yet, but my mom, mi mamá, suggested it to me. So, that's kind of
she did as well. Good.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So that's my experience with him. I don't know if Danielle, you have more.
Once upon a time, young baby Danielle, film student, was told that she should purchase a DVD of E2 Mama, and I did. And it was both really great and really hot. And it's a beautiful coming of age story, mm-hmm. to young men who are best of friends, and they they meet a hot lady on a beach.
Great.
And there's a lot going on. There's a lot there as well, in terms of like class stratification in Mexico, and in terms of slice of life kind of stuff, and the things that people do, and the things that young people do. It's obviously very, mm-hmm. very, very different from Roma. But in terms of like kind of creating the fresco, which Rob in the sort of notes, and I know we'll go into this, but there's this sort of beautiful thread from Guillermo del Toro about how this movie is a fresco, and it literally, mm-hmm. it's moving. It's always sort of gently moving in these wide, beautiful, long shots, showing the sort of patchwork tapestry of life in this very specific place and time, and sort of this milieu, to mm-hmm. use a you know, put a little riendo spin onto it, right?
First of all, actually, the notes for this episode were Natalie's, at least as far as this section goes, because she was super hyped to talk about this. But if you haven't followed what Roma is, to give you a sketch, like mm-hmm. When you think of Cuarón, if your last exposures to Cuarón were like Gravity and Children of Men. This recognizably has some stylistic elements and flourishes of his. Like, it is recognizably one of his films, but this is at once one of his most personal works, I would say. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there's autobiographical elements, but it's also the most, I would say, grounded in an actual place and time and real world events. It's a domestic drama shot like and produced like an historical epic, mm-hmm. and it follows follows the story of basically a domestic servant in late 1960s, early 1970s Mexico, mm-hmm. Named Cleo, and she is a servant of a fairly high status Mexican family of,
yeah, they're at least like upper middle class.
Yeah, like professional, like one is a doctor, one is a scientist. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's a husband and wife, the doctor, and a biochemist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. is his wife, and as the movie opens, we sort of begin with the daily routine of Cleo.
Cleo de Garia, just right, like the most beautiful name, but yeah, she's referred to as Cleo.
Yeah, but it's much more. It's if you're thinking like some sort of upstairs downstairs like British class drama, this really isn't that. This is much more of a very personal story backdropped against massive social upheaval and the places those intersect.
Mm-hmm. It's just so brilliantly interwoven, like everything that's happening. And yeah, that Guillermo del Toro thread that you were talking about, Danielle, I like happened upon that thread right after I'd seen the movie, like minutes after I'd seen the movie. And it has like that specific tweet of, you know, that this is a mural, that this is not a portrait. It is like, you know, showing a little scrolling sort of landscape, yeah. has like stuck in my head. And I think that's like one of its greatest achievements. I like, maybe I'll change my tune in like a couple years when I'm wiser and who knows, but I like felt like this was just a masterpiece. In every single regard. And I wanted to highlight the lead actress, Yalitza Aparicio. She is of Mixtec Inriqui descent, and she was born in Oaxaca. This is her, she plays Cleo, who is the, housekeeper slash nanny of the family. And she is based on Liboria Rodriguez, which is Alfonso's childhood nanny. So this is autobiographical. It's about him growing up in Mexico City. I think it's about specifically him growing up in this neighborhood, which is called Roma. That's why the film is called Roma, because the neighborhood is called Roma. And this is her first acting role. She initially... she had just graduated from school with a teaching degree, and her sister was the one who tried out for the role, but her sister was pregnant at the time and couldn't, and so her sister was just like, you should go, and she was like, well, I have some time, like, before, you know, I get my exams back for whatever, so I guess I'll try out, and then she got the job, and she was like, okay, well, I guess I have time right now to do this thing, so I'll do it. And she, if you haven't heard, has been nominated for Best Actress by the Academy. This marks the first time an Indigenous woman has been nominated for Best Actress, and the first time in 14 years that a Latina has been nominated for Best Actress. Which is significant. I mean, it means so much to see an Indigenous woman, like, in this space and, like, having commanded it, like, with such grace and finesse, and she's just, she, like, I, like, when I think of her, I get, like, emotional. I just have a lot of, like, pride and joy for that story.
Well, and I think it's not just, you know, that she was cast in this role, but really this is a story that touches on class divides in Mexico, and not just mm-hmm. between rich and poor, but also like ethnic background mm-hmm. In Mexico, and the way that often does tie to socioeconomic status, or mm-hmm. also the fact that there are entire regions of Mexico that are kind of relegated to second class status as far as the government's interest on them. There are regions, there are places the government serves, and there's places the government sort of preys upon in mm-hmm. in Mexico. And I think she becomes a fascinating figure in this film because she stands at the center of she stands at so many so many liminal spaces within mm-hmm. Mexican society at this moment, and all the sort of tumults that's surrounding them begins to affect her, even as her own personal life also begins to spiral a little bit out of control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she... I found a New York Times article that interviewed Yalitza, and also there's this a specific quote about, you know, the development of the movie, in which the actors were not given a script or a story arc, the woman who plays Adela, which is the sort of chef of the household, Nancy Garcia Garcia, she's actually like Yalitza's best friend in real life. When they were doing development and, you know, like rehearsing and stuff like that, Cuarón would just have them like together and like just like kind of talking, like the span, like platicando, like just like chatting, but they weren't like chatting as, you know, as like their selves from teaching, like as their real selves. They were like fully in character and just like created this whole story out of like the setting that Cuarón like provided. And it's so incredible to me, like the nuance of the dialogue between them was one of the great, it like sounded like I don't, it just sounded so real. It just sounded like I was there, like I was like in Guatemala and like just like in the house and like just like a fly on the wall. And it sounded like, you know, you know, even like the walking through the streets and you hear like all this, all the vendors, and it's all like layered on top of each other, and like everything just like feels like so real and like grounded, and like it's not nostalgia. It's like something, it's like just like familiar and like homey feel. I don't know. It's difficult.
I think the, so I watched this very much. Like yesterday I gave a cinematography lecture mm-hmm. to my students in my film and TV class. And then I watched this last night, like I cuddled up in bed. I know I apologize. I did not see it in theaters, but it was also a really good experience. I curled up in bed, and it does feel like, okay, it's a domestic drama. This is like a very, very, in many ways, it feels like a very big movie, because it literally, half of this movie, maybe even more than half of this movie, is in wide shots. Like, yeah, really, huge. Really, really pulled out, and really giving you such a sense of all of this movement and all this texture and all of this sort of just motion of life and mm-hmm. sort of, you know, different people kind of coming and going. But I curled up and watched it and was just so completely drawn into the way it does use like negative space, and the way it does have like big beautiful skies in a lot of places, and then also like busy cities and mm-hmm. busy everything. Like every single frame in this movie, okay, maybe not every single frame, so many frames in this movie are so busy mm-hmm. and big and beautiful, and yet are still so completely intimate and personal and speak so directly to this character's life. And that to me is like beyond an achievement. Like to mm-hmm. to do this with wide shots, to do what they have done with wide shots here mm-hmm. is like, holy shit, you know, like create this performance without using a lot of close-ups. It's like, wow, that is, holy crap. Yeah. Like, that is really, truly mind-blowing to me, like how that was done.
Well, and I think like the Del Toro thread that we referenced earlier mentions that, and I did not know this watching the film, I found out when I read that thread afterwards, mm-hmm. that they built basically a 6-square block set of this version of Mexico City built off Cuarón's memories and recollections of the place, because mm-hmm. wow. you know, a lot of it is gone. A lot of it would have been hard to recreate. But I would have bet you my bottom dollar that was shot on location.
Yeah, like I would have,
like totally. It's huge. Like
it looks like Mexico City. Like
yeah.
the way that like that the like the home has like that like front gate or whatever, and everything like is in the back. Like that is just. That's how it is. Like, you know what I mean? And like, it just, it felt, the fact that it was all built in a back lot is just unbelievable to me.
Yeah.
Well, and so there's the fact it's a constructed set. And then there's the fact that it is just an incredibly gorgeous black and white film. Yes. And you do not see many of those anymore. I was reading a little bit about, so it definitely sounds like at this point Cuarón's at that phase in his career where he can basically get whatever he wants. And what he got, it sounds like, is basically a by hand coloring of these black and white frames off the 65mm digital camera. And so there's a good piece at IndieWire talking about how does the movie look this good, because it's not like you can just flip the camera to like black and white mode and get something. Right. You know, you can't just like desaturate the color and get this effect. So what Cuarón and Technicolor did apparently was they used post-process effects to basically shade every frame of this film. I'm not clear to what degree some of that was algorithmic mm-hmm. where you just feed the film through and that process would be applied versus mm-hmm. how much was basically done by hand. But the result is a film that look like it's strange. It is a gorgeous film, but it is so, what's the way to put this?
Like texture? I don't know.
No, it's the way I put it is I forget that I'm watching film. It's the mm-hmm. strangest thing. Like the early shots where she's serving the family their midday meal mm-hmm. and she goes back out to the kitchen where the servants are eating. They're sitting by the window. The window's mm-hmm. open. The light's filtering down through it. You feel like you're there. And like, yeah. just from the way the color, just from the color, the way the motes of dust in the air are moving around the curtains, you can feel the air. Like, you know, you know that space, you know everything about that moment. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel like, sometimes you see a film, particularly a digital film, and you're like incredibly aware of the medium. Mm-hmm. You're incredibly aware of like, you know, the little bit of digital grain there, a little bit of noise here and there. Everything here just feels like you're seeing it. And in his remarks, like Cuarón says that he was basically trying to make a film that looks like the human eye perceives things.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, mission accomplished.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Good on you.
Yeah, the when she's like, you know, these aren't like, I don't think we should go into like spoiler territory maybe, because since this isn't Be Good and Rewatch It, like I'm sure people are getting the suggestion to go, or like gonna get the bug to go see it, so I don't want to get too into spoiler territory. But when she's like walking, when walking through the bedrooms and the dust is just like floating in the air, like little, like it feels so natural and like tangible. In a way that's not like what's the word I'm looking for? Like realistic in the mm-hmm. digital sense, if that makes sense. So and something that I think is just remarkable about this film is how it feels like every moment like has, like everyone is always doing something in every moment. I think if you don't want to know anything about the film going into it, skip to like a minute ahead. But when Cleo and Adela are sitting in the restaurant, and Fermin and Ramon like come up behind them, and Fermin is just and Fermin is just like, they offer them food and Fermin and Ramon are like, no, we're fine. But Fermin just like has this like stare at Cleo that he's like, it's just like unrelenting, like it's just not breaking, and it's like the most like unsettling, intense thing. But it's not obvious because he's like far in the background. He's like at least like 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 like layers pushed back in terms of like what's in the each setting, and he's like kind of hazy or whatever, but he's just like looking at Cleo and like not breaking. And it is just like it just, you wouldn't really notice it, but it just, it feels like, and that's like everywhere. It's like, it just feels so wholly encompassed. Like everything feels, and what's incredible to me is that so much of that is like, could be just natural. Like so much of that might not have been directed. Especially when considering like Cleo and Adela's dialogue or whatever, like them, you know, their back and forth, them being, you know, in their quarter, in their sort of like maids quarters together, like just like kind of chatting and like doing their little doing the stretches and stuff, and like, you know, talking, like referencing the tamales that they ate earlier, the tortas, like just like that. It's so good. It's just, mwah, I love it. It's so good. I'm just totally infatuated.
Well, it also does become a movie about gender and work as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because another theme of this movie is life goes on, but particularly work goes on. Work is unending for these women. And no matter what is happening, Cleo has to continue doing her job as a domestic servant.
Yeah. And no matter how close she is to the family and how much, you know, Pepe is like, stay with me, like, be with me. Like, she will get asked to, like, go, you know, fetch something. Or, you know, like, why is the house, what, you know, she's there. She's always, like, pulled in and pushed out and pulled in and pushed out.
Liminal social space as well as, you know, physical spaces, and also, you know, sort of social status as well. Yeah, that was really something I noticed early on, when she is sort of clearing you know, the table and everybody's watching TV and having a laugh. And she kind of goes and, you know, is able to kind of cuddle and like be part of the family in some ways for a second. And then it's like, oh, can you go get the doctor some tea? We got to go make some chamomile. And it's like, oh, I back to work now. She keeps yeah, being almost invited in and welcomed in. And then, oh, no, you're still the help. You know, that kind of attitude still exists towards her. No matter how much the family does love her,
mm-hmm.
she is still.
And how much she loves them.
And like, she loves them.
She does every, like, every action is just done with the care and love that, like, is developed like through these types of that can be developed through these types of relationships, in which, you know, she wakes up the children with like a Mistek like lullaby, or she puts them to sleep with a little Mistek lullaby, and in the morning she like wakes them up with like a little Mistek song, and it's just such a, like, you feel such a the love that she like has for the children, and even like the respect that she has for Senora Sofia, which is, it's intense. It's really, it, this whole movie is so intense.
But this is the other thing. It also has such a wonderful sense of humor about this movie.
It is not like intense in the way that like you feel like you're being throttled the whole time, but
there's one of the funniest and best characters in this movie is oh gosh, who makes it? It's the Galaxy, but is it a Ford Galaxy?
Oh. Yes, the Ford Galaxy.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it's.
I think it is.
I'm pretty sure it is.
I can't. Yeah.
This car.
Yeah, this is one of those big fuck off 1960s.
Just wide as shit.
Yeah, it's just massive, and it is the beloved pet of the doctor,
mm-hmm.
and the car is a symbol of just a shit ton of things. But also, it's just too goddamn big. It is so big. And it pops up in so many scenes at the most weird and inappropriate, but it's always a relief when it does.
Yeah,
like the recurring bits around this car are incredible, and the way different characters interact with this car particularly the particularly Senora Sofia's changing relationship with the car.
Yeah.
It's amazing, and it's, you know, it arrives at some of the heaviest moments, but God, there is a sequence where she, I think, Natalie, you pointed out in your notes, and it absolutely killed me. She's in traffic, and she sees a pretty big gap between two trucks. Like, there's a lane.
Which is, in comparison to, I just want to note, like, this is in comparison to a scene from before in which, Senor, what's his name?
The doctor,
yeah. Antonio, where he pulls into the driveway, because I think it's important. Where he pulls into the driveway, and there's and he's pulling in, and then he like taps, you know, a little thing, and then he pulls it out, and it's all focused on his hands and his cigarette and him. Like,
it's shot like a 50s thriller.
Yeah,
these are the close-ups in this movie.
Yeah,
like on these details,
it's like, so good. And he's just like, and he's like trying to avoid the pile of dog shit, but then he can't avoid it and has to run over it. And it's just so drawn out, but it's like so meticulous. And then to compare it to like a few minutes later, when Rob, you were going to say, sorry to jump in.
No, she sees a pretty big gap between two trucks, and she decides to like try to thread it like Luke Skywalker taking the X-Wing down the trench, and things don't go as planned. But what is great is also there's the weirdest exchange of looks between the two truck drivers and Senora Sofia at the wheel. It is just the most like well, I guess our lives are all bound up in this moment type recognition of, well, we share this. We are.
It's so wild because she goes for it and then she has like 5 seconds of it not working. And she just, and she's so funny. She has her hands on the wheel and she has her little finger up and she's like doing a little thing with her finger. She's like, like, I don't know, just like the tiniest little detail. And then she just, through these two trucks and they're like, and exactly what you said, Rob, they're like, well, this is it, this is just us now,
this is our life now.
And I mean, this is like, I don't undersell it, this movie makes some hard turns in terms of it's about and what is happening, particularly like what is happening in the background of its world. This movie wrecked me midway through. But at the same time, it is just one of the most heartwarming. Heartwarming sounds like a branded word. Heartwarming sounds like a bullshit. It sounds
like Hallmark or some shit.
Yeah, and yet I think, you know, there's so much sense of life as it happens in this film, good and bad, that it recognizes complicated realities without reducing them to a caricature, like the fact that you can be a domestic servant and in a way a member of the family, and those two things, you can travel between those two statuses and it's very fluid. It doesn't necessarily mean their love is insincere, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you're being completely exploited, but there's all these shadings of nuance and meaning in every interaction, and that can be warm and reassuring, and it can be disappointing and upsetting. And I think this is the thing that I just adore about this movie, is that for the most part, all these characters and their relationships are given so much respect and sensitivity and humanity, even as their flaws are recognized. And it is so evocative of people in a time and place. You know, when they go to Veracruz toward the end, which is where a lot of my family were from. So, you know, a lot of stories in my family about, you know, going down to visit Uncle Junior at his place in Veracruz. And watching this movie also made me realize, it also reminded me of something my mom always said, which was that when she went on vacation through Mexico with her father, and they all piled in to the family station wagon and drove through Mexico. The fact that he was always a little uptight, always a little jittery on the roads between cities. And this was a movie that sort of also reminded me, like, oh shit, like, yeah, 70s Mexico, there was a lot of upheaval and unrest. And so you could have that charming seaside resort, and also this awareness that in some ways this can be a country that's fraying at the seams.
Yeah, for every warm like memory there, like in this movie, there's also like just like some of the deepest pain. And it's not singular. Like, I don't know how to convey that. It is like so layered between so many different things that are happening in Mexico at this time, between so many different, you know, themes and motivations and you know, it just feels so monumental in like the widest sense. It's just mwah, I love it. it is a great film.
All right. We will take a quick break there, and up next we're going to talk about opioids, the Sackler family, and you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together.
J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
All right. So my waypoint this week is a couple articles that both stem from basically the same court filing from a case that's currently underway here in Massachusetts. The first is an article by Barry Meyer over at the New York Times, and the second is by Beth Moll at Ars Technica. But they both cover some filings relating to an ongoing lawsuit against several members of the Sackler family and executives and the company itself of Purdue Pharmaceutical. And it all stems from the company's role in making and marketing OxyContin and the growing opioid epidemic that's sort of been sweeping America for probably, you know, the better part of two decades at this point. And one of the things that was really astonishing in this article is that in this court filing, the Attorney General's office in Massachusetts has a lot of internal company communications from Purdue Pharmaceutical. And what is revealed in these communications is the degree to which Purdue Pharmaceutical were kind of aware from the beginning of the dangers OxyContin posed and the role it was playing in creating a growing a growing population of opioid addicts, and the degree to which Purdue not only blew those risks off, but kind of just went full speed ahead with marketing the drug and basically doing a lot of things that imply a degree of tacit permission and encouragement of abuse of the drug, of unwise prescription of the drug,
and targeting specifically, you know, people that were already at risk, to target them to start using the drug, or if they were already.
Yeah, one of the things, and then as the epidemic begins to take off, there's internal communications where you see executives kind of wondering what they should do about it. And the CEO of Purdue at the time, Richard Sackler, who's a member of the family that owns it, their private company, basically saying that it's important that the company get out ahead of this and make sure that everyone knows that addicts are reckless criminals. And they are misusing and abusing their medication. And the implication being that it's not on anyone else. It's drug addicts' fault if they get addicted and eventually overdose or turn to more traditional opiates. And it's just it's a stunning read. And the other thing that's stunning is the degree to which so much of this happened almost in the open and with a lot of awareness from both Purdue Pharmaceutical, but also a lot of permission from government agencies.
Yeah, that's part of what's so upsetting about this. This is something I've gotten into a lot of fights on Twitter about with people who maybe know a little less about this sort of thing than I do, about how, you know, in most of our world, most of the evil, most of the truest expressions of evil, most of the really the worst shit tends to have many causes, right? There's a whole lot of conflating factors that allow really terrible things to happen, really awful people with bad motivations, a lot of bad actors to do terrible things. And this is one of those rare cases where it's pretty fucking easy to pinpoint what happened here. It's pretty fucking easy to pinpoint it on the greed and avarice of a very small group of very rich people who are running the show here. And I think a lot of these documents show just how fucking damning the evidence is for just how completely, not only reckless, but really, really malicious. I would say malicious. Whether they wanted people to literally die or not, these are not good intentions. These are not, I want to help people who are in pain. This is, I want to fucking
make a shit ton of money.
Make a shit ton of money, and I don't care who gets hurt in the process. And yeah, there's a whole lot of looking away. So you could certainly say, yes, there's many conflating factors. We live in a shitty capitalistic society where things like medicine and healthcare are goods and services as opposed to, you know, sort of things that are necessary for living and sustaining human life. And, mm-hmm. you know, the things that maybe they really actually are or should be. Of course, you could say that. But this really is one of those shining things where it's like, oh, no, this one is... Just straight in there. This is evil with a capital E. This is terrible. And it's hard for me not to make moral pronouncements about this. I will say I had a, this is not spoiler warning. This is a content alert. We already kind of said this, but I had a cousin who died of an opioid overdose a couple years ago. Sort of like the next day I had to go for extra Narcan training, like how to use nasal Narcan to sort of stop an overdose.
For people who don't.
I'm an EMT and I am an emergency medical technician, and one of the drugs that we carry on our ambulance is nasal Narcan, which reverses opioid addiction. Basically, if you can get it into someone quickly enough during their overdose, you can reverse the effects of the opioids. They actually wake up really quickly. It's like a really it's one of those cool drugs. This one works really well. Not everything works super well. This one works really well typically if you get it in there soon enough, basically. Mm-hmm. If somebody's found of a suspected overdose, and it's easy to use. You put it in the nose. Like, it's actually like,
this is something like available to people that they can now like have on their like normal people, like not just EMT.
They give it out like candy. Yeah
you can like carry this. Like, a lot of people have been, you know, because of the increase in fentanyl that's been especially in like New York, there is a lot higher prevalence of fentanyl in cocaine and Xanax and other like random prescription drugs that are fake and not real, and fentanyl dosage, like the fatal fentanyl dosage, is tiny.
It is
like minuscule. And so a lot of people are, you know, promoting carrying
as you know, it is a lifesaver, but it obviously is it's going to be a lifesaver of one overdose. It's not going to save a person from being addicted to this drug. And you know, the typical, I guess, just to say, a very, very common narrative, which goes completely against what these, you know, vultures are trying to say about, oh, addicts are, you know, reckless criminals or whatever, is somebody who took this drug given to them by their doctor, by their legitimate MD, who was in turn told this is a safe drug that we've tested. It's gone through, you know, every round of testing, and it's safe to use. It's safe to use for this dosing. We don't have to talk about the specifics, but a lot of what happened here had to do with the dosing, with how it's dosed and how dangerous it is at particular doses. So somebody, what happens a lot, again, and I have seen this in my own family, I've seen this happen. Somebody took their prescription drugs for their pain. They had surgery. They had whatever. They get addicted to opioids. Their doctor cuts them off at some point because, at one point it kind of came out like, oh, yeah, this stuff is not safe at all. It's dosed weirdly. It has a lot of different effects on different people. Even for every drug, obviously, is a little bit different on every human being. But this is wildly, like, the dosing is wildly sort of out of sync for what people actually need for this one. And then they turn to, you know, to opioids on the street because they can't do anything else. They can't get any other sort of prescriptions from a doctor. So it becomes this, you know, the sort of typical thing of like a person who has all sorts of other things going on in their life, who is not sort of what people would have stereotypically associated with drug use or recreational drug use, now becomes sort of, you know, an opioid addict because of this, like how widespread this was, you know?
And this stuff, like, is sort of raised in these articles. One of the things that that is revealed in this court filing is that you see an awful lot of Purdue executives, and particularly, again, Richard Sackler, pushing to keep increasing the sales force and the overall sales of OxyContin. And you know, you've got him. There's just unreal quotes, like when the drug was approved in 1995. You've got Sackler quoted as saying the launch of OxyContin tablets will be followed by a blizzard of prescriptions that will bury the competition. Oh, the God. Prescription blizzard will be so deep, dense, and white. The other part of this,
oxycodone is a white pill.
It is.
Yeah. The other part of this is that their pharma reps were out there telling doctors that OxyContin carried less addiction risk than typical, because doctors know how dangerous yes. Opiates are. They've known this for ages. We went through all of this decades ago. But when OxyContin hit, you had Purdue reps going out there telling doctors that the drug was less abusable, less addictive than, say, heroin or morphine had been. And this is where you start. This is where things start really getting even more upsetting. Yeah. When the FDA approved OxyContin in 1995, the FDA also has to sign off on the claims you make in marketing a drug. They allowed Purdue to claim that the opioid was believed to reduce the addictiveness of the pills. The research, I guess, was not in on that point. So, sure, they were allowed to sort of put that marketing line in. And then you had Purdue basically saying, like, lead the sales pitch with that. And so they began really pushing hard to market the pill on the back of it being less addictive. And the numbers of, the sales force they began to recruit for Purdue Pharma were pretty staggering too. Between 2007 and 2016, Purdue went from having 300 pharma reps to 700 reps out there pushing their products. But The other part of this that's again kind of astonishing is this lawsuit is all happening today, but Purdue already pleaded guilty to federal charges in 2007. They paid I think it was kind of a record fine of $634.5 million in fines, and several executives pleaded to federal misdemeanors stemming from this previous court case. But a thing to bear in mind is that, according to a New Yorker article about the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma, OxyContin netted them like $35 billion.
Yup, that's so
like that wild. Fine, which federal prosecutors were like, "Yeah, we got them. We did it. You were. This is back in 2007. We punished them for misrepresenting the drug's risk." Man, that is an easy cost of doing business to write off. Like $35 billion versus $634 million. Who gives a shit?
Mm-hmm.
And then things kept getting worse. Like part of the deal, and this is why this lawsuit is happening. Part of the deal was that Purdue had to meet certain compliance criteria as part of that settlement. One of which is, as I understand, they needed to scale down their marketing operation and make sure they stopped misrepresenting the drug's risk. And instead of that happening, Purdue kind of stepped on the gas in terms of selling the drugs and pushing pharma reps to adopt really aggressive sales tactics to market OxyContin. And just a thing to note is the U.S. attorney who oversaw the 2007 settlement, John Brownlee, he's no longer a U.S. attorney. He works at a big law firm, Holland & Knight, and he heads a department there. But one of the things that the firm does is they lobby Congress on drug policy. They also represent drug manufacturers. I believe right now they are representing a company called Insys, who make opioids. And they are being defended in that case by a former federal prosecutor. And so Our adversarial legal system seems to produce a lot of government attorneys who, if they're working for the people, it's a temporary gig.
This stuff is really, really, really stunning. And also, I think it does have to come with some sort of other, like the other end of this, of what a tremendous tragedy it is sort of how it has moved our society in certain ways. Like there are, this epidemic is specifically linked with a massive amount of sort of orphans, with little kids who both parents have died of overdoses, with like entire counties in the South, in the Midwest, and in several regions of the U.S. where like orphanages are packed to the gills with little kids who like just lost both of their parents, mm-hmm. or they lost so much of their family. So many people have died because of this and because of these direct actions that it's just absolutely, yeah, like if you want to get really, really, really angry or really jaded and have no hope for humanity, read these pieces, right?
Well, I just, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like, it's so fucking like system, like it is a system. It is like it's like a fully like self-supporting system. And in 2011 they started selling what was it called again, buprenorphine, which is a like opioid reversal
antagonist.
Yeah, where is it? Okay, yeah, it can treat pain as well as addiction to narcotic pain relievers, which is just, of course, you know, like what the like.
We're gonna help you quit. We want the best for you, and the other parts of this. So if you another place that did some great reporting on this is the Charleston Gazette Mail in West Virginia. They did a great series of reports about how this all unfolded in West Virginia. And the numbers of pills being shipped into West Virginia are astonishing given the population of that state. And there were two DEA agents assigned to the entire state. And one of the things they're supposed to monitor is doctor's offices that prescribe a suspicious number of opioids.
Pill factories, yeah.
They didn't pursue it. They didn't really keep track of that. And as a result, West Virginia got hammered by the opioid epidemic. Now, there's things left out of the story in this telling, and I can't really give them their due here. This absolutely has an element of there's a point where prescription drug abuse begins to intersect with the importation of heroin, particularly from cartels in Mexico. That is also a major part of the story and a major driver of this, and that's just not something that these two articles are really going to tackle. I've just started reading a really good book called Dreamland that is about that sort of interaction between legal prescription opioids and black tar heroin, and that's seems like it's going to be a hell of a great book on the subject. The other thing that doesn't really get us doing these articles is it's very easy to generalize about pill mills and shitty doctors just writing reckless prescriptions for OxyContin. There are a lot of people with chronic pain and like genuine like injuries that can't really be fixed or mitigated, just lived with. For a lot of folks like that, opioids did provide badly needed relief. There are people who need serious pain medication. And in the reaction to this, and Danielle, you alluded to it, a lot of overdose cases being people who were sort of cut off from the pills by their doctor after developing a dependency on it. That's another dimension of this is as the country, as government agencies have tried to sort of push the toothpaste back in the tube, the people they've sort of caught in the crossfire are people who have legitimate need for these medications.
Absolutely.
And neither the conversation nor the policy really recognizes their legitimate interests or needs. And so they're getting screwed in this as well, because at this point we're well past the point where we're monitoring people who are prescribing opioids can make a huge difference. That's the horses have bolted from that particular barn. Mm-hmm. But our policy is still acting as if people getting oxycodone prescriptions is the problem.
Yeah, it's unreal. Opioids are absolutely a necessary part of palliative care. They're a necessary part of so many things. And they are also treated like a Band-Aid for working class folks. This is another element of this, of how hard working class folks have been hit by this. People who, you know, work with their hands, people who work construction, people who work any given job and get hurt and have no job security and not necessarily any decent health insurance. And, you know, the best they can possibly do is get some painkillers. Maybe they can't afford the surgery that'll fix something. Maybe they can't get something else. So that has compounded it so much. I mean, this is something that has affected people from any class, any imaginable class. However, as usual, the people who are the worst off get it the worst with anything like this. And it's been atrocious for folks in that situation. So that is another – there was a piece – this doesn't go directly into that super, super far, but the piece on the sort of, I'm so sorry, I can't remember the name of the article. I can like find it and put it in the show notes. But the great expose by the woman who's a lesbian cable guy goes into little bit about like how many of us like have to take painkillers just to get through the day, or have to do certain things just to get through the day because we're on our feet all day, because we're falling off of ladders and things like this are happening. But yeah, that's another piece that like goes into how blue collar workers are absolutely like even more disproportionately affected by this sort of really malicious practice.
Oh God, I can't remember what the name of
I will definitely
here it
find
is.
It.
I think it
okay,
is.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's called I Was a Cable Guy, I Saw the Worst of America, from the Huffington Post, written by Lauren Hugh.
Yeah, Lauren Hugh. Yeah, she goes into it a little bit.
Yeah, she talks about it. She talks about her experience as a cable service person, cable technician, and also, yeah, talks about the... here's actually the quote. That's the thing. Here's one little piece. That's the thing they don't tell you about opiate addiction. People are in pain because unless you went to college, the only way you'll earn a decent living is by breaking your body or risking your life. Plumbers, electricians, steam fitters, welders, mechanics, cable guys, linemen, fishermen, garbage men. The options are endless. And
vets too, if we want to add that sort of
of course
in the end there. But yeah,
this is a great article that goes into like a more personal profile of being affected by opiate addiction, not like personally having an addiction to opiates, but being in, you know, the realm, or being in the job class of seeing friends
seeing a lot of
suffer
it, yeah.
from that.
But yeah, it's an upsetting topic to look at, because it's one of those, as the case of so many crises we are facing right now, it's one that was eminently foreseeable. It's one that largely happened out in the open. And with intent, and the
not even like foreseeable, but like planned.
Yep.
Yeah,
yeah, practically,
right?
Yeah,
I mean, according to like the documents found in these two articles, that you know,
it was it was a great marketing opportunity, and they seized it with both hands. And it's one of those things where it's not just one, you know, evil company doing this stuff. Their accomplices are, you know, at every level of government, people just cutting them a break, regulatory agencies just making a concession, saying I'll allow it on something that really shouldn't be allowed. And it's just a painful thing to go researching and looking into, because until, like, it's one of those things that until you really look at it, you don't realize how much of this shit didn't just happen, right? Yeah. I think there's this narrative of, oh, you know, the economic crisis, and in those left behind regions of America, people don't have anything, so they turn to you know, oxy and heroin, and it's like, no, that's bullshit, right? That's one of those vague, hand wavy rationalizations that blames a crisis that should be put at the feet of actual bad actors and says, oh, it was just the zeitgeist. The zeitgeist was heroin. So, yeah. So anyway, good read. It's well worth looking into. And it's eye opening to see how pharma executives, speak when they think that these materials will never be subpoenaed. So go and give those a look, and there will be lots of show notes on this one, and supplemental materials in the post on the website. That will do it for our show today. Our thanks to Too Mellow for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at toomellowmakes.bandcamp.com. You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Danielle, where can people find you?
At Danielle R.I.
Natalie?
At Natalie Watson.
All right. That'll do it for this week's Waypoints. We hope you've enjoyed the break. Be sure to rate and review us if you're on your podcast platform of choice, if they allow such a thing. I think we're a 5-star cast, but it's not for me to say. We'll be back again with Waypoint Radio on Friday, and you should also be sure and listen to our new podcast, Be Good and Rewatch It, where we just revisited Unbreakable, and now we're taking a look at Split as we consider the unlikely arc of M. Night Shyamalan's superhero trilogy. And boy, has that been a ride.
Yeah, seriously. And it's in a new feed, so find it.
Check it out.
Yeah, we're not putting those in the main feed anymore. So if you want to hear us talk about major movies, popular movies, movies we just want to talk about, go look up Be Good and Rewatch It. We hope you'll join us for that. We hope you'll join us again. But until then, do not give in to astonishment.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Sorry, I don't know. Can I just say something really quick? Why don't people fucking look at the sign that says the room is being used? Why are people just fucking barging in?
Okay. Yeah, sorry. What the fuck was that?
Someone just walked into a
fucking...
It was the Hammerman.
Hammerman?
Yeah, from earlier, remember? I was like, there's a man with a hammer.
Ah.
There's a man with a hammer.
Anyway. Be careful what you say then.